the dozen charges, only to have everything dropped overnight. The men meet Maidenhair at her release. They see her through the chicken wire window, walking down the women's wing with a little hobo's ball of her stuff in her hands. Then she's on them, embracing. She steps back and narrows her fire-green eyes.
I want to see it.
They take Adam's car, which seems to him now like it belongs to someone else. The loggers are gone. There's nothing left to cut. They've long since headed to fresh groves. The absence is obvious from half a mile away, where once there was a green weave of textures you could study all day. There's only blue. The tree that promised her that no one would be harmed is gone. Now, Adam thinks, now she'll decompensate, begin to rage. At the base, her hand stretches out, touching some final proof, amazed.
Look at that! Even the stump is taller than me!
She touches the edge of the wondrous cut and breaks down, sobbing. Nick stumbles toward her, but she holds him off. Adam must watch every awful spasm. There are consolations that the strongest human love is powerless to give.
Where will you go? Adam asks over eggs in a breakfast roadhouse.
Maidenhair gazes out the plate glass, where California sycamores run along the sidewalk by the curb. Watchman follows her glance. These two, raking their fingers in the air, waving and swelling like a gospel choir.
We're heading north, she answers. Something's happening up in Oregon.
Resistance communities, Watchman says, all over the place. They can use us up there.
Adam nods. Ethnography is over.
Did they tell you this? Your voices?
She bursts into a curt, wild laugh.
No! The deputy sheriff loaned me her jogging radio. I think she had a thing for me. You should come with us.
Well, I have this research to finish, my dissertation.
Work on it up there. The place will be filled with the people you want to study.
Idealists, Watchman says.
Adam can't read the man. Somewhere up in the tree or in his narrow cell, he lost the ability to tell sardonic from straight.
I can't.
Ah. Well, if you can't, you can't.
Maybe she's being sympathetic. Maybe she's felling him.
We'll meet you up there when you come around.
Adam carries the curse back to Santa Cruz. For weeks he works up his data. Almost 200 people have answered the 240 questions of the revised NEO personality inventory. They've also completed his custom questionnaire, testing for various beliefs, including thoughts on human entitlement to natural resources, the scope of personhood, and plant rights. Digitizing the results is trivial. He runs his data through various analysis packages. Professor Van Dijk has a look. Nice work. Took you a while. Anything exciting happen during the fieldwork? Something has happened to his libido while he was away. Professor Van Dijk is as hot as ever, but she seems to Adam like another species.
Does 5 days in jail count as exciting?
She thinks he's kidding. He lets her think so. Certain tendencies of radical environmentalist temperament emerge from the data. Core values, a sense of identity. The scores of only 4 of the 30 personality factors measured by the NEO inventory turn out to predict with remarkable accuracy whether a person will believe a forest deserves protection regardless of its value to humans. He wants to give himself the exam, but it would say nothing now. Back at his apartment after 10 hours in the computer lab, Adam turns on the TV. Oil wars and sectarian violence. It's way too early to think about sleeping, though that's all he wants to do. He's still a score of stories up in the air, held aloft by a non-existent tree, listening to the creak of that high house and the call of birds he'd like to be able to name. He tries to read a novel, something about privileged people having trouble getting along with each other in exotic locations. He throws it against the wall. Something has broken in him. His appetite for human self-regard is dead. He heads out to a favorite grad student hang, where he consumes 5 beers, 96 decibels of blast beat, and 100 minutes of wall-sized sine-wave basketball in the company of 20 instant friends. Ejected again from the cocoon of fun, he regroups in the bar's parking lot. He's not so buzzed as to imagine he's fit to drive, but there's no other way home. Waves of simulated mirth pump out of the building as a parade of muscle cars snarls down Cabrillo. A woman under a streetlight shouts at no one,
"Fuck me for even trying to understand you!"
Across the alley, people wait to be admitted into the back entrance of some late-night invitation-only event that Adam, juked by the sight of the mini-throng, suddenly needs to attend. Another human irrationality he knows all about, but is too fried to remember by name. He walks half a block, propelled by a tremendous wave that feeds on itself, jetting out refuse behind it. Bubbles, genocides, crusades, manias, from the pyramids to pet rocks. The desperate delusions of culture, from which, for one brief night, high up above the earth, he once awakened. At the corner, he leans on a streetlight. A fact struggles to escape him, one he has felt for a long time but has never been able to formulate. Almost every part of need is created by a reflex, phantasmal, and democratic committee whose job is to turn one season's necessities into the next's yard sales. He stumbles on into a park full of people dealing in excitement and night. The air stinks a little of wet naps, weed, and sex. Hunger everywhere, and the only food is salt. Something hard hits his head, falls to the ground, and rolls a few feet away. He crouches down in the dark and searches. The culprit lies in the grass, a mysterious industrial-grade button incised on its flat, round face with a perfect X. It seems designed to be opened with a large Phillips head screwdriver and has the look of steampunk. Ingenious, Victorian, finely machined. But it's made of wood. The thing is too weird for words. He studies it for a full minute, learning again how he knows nothing. Nothing outside his own kind. He looks up into the branches of a willowy eucalyptus from which the mystery fell. The thick bole has started its species' trademark striptease. Sheaves of brown, thin bark litter the base, leaving behind a trunk so white it's obscene. "What?" he asks the tree.
"What?"
The tree feels no need to reply. The 7 miles of Forest Service Road are so glorious it scares him. Adam follows the cut, climbing along sentry conifers, spruce to hemlock to Douglas fir, yew, red cedar, 3 kinds of true firs, all of which he sees as pine. A year-long dissertation completion fellowship, a gift from the gods, and this is how he spends it. His pack weighs down on his hips. Above him, in the blue, the sun acts like it'll never hide again. But the crisp air and early shadows in the switchbacks hint at what's coming. A few more weeks, and his thesis will be done. First this, though. A last bit of holdout research. The Northwest has more miles of logging road than public highway. more miles of logging road than streams. The country has enough to circle the earth a dozen times. The cost of cutting them is tax deductible, and the branches are growing faster than ever, as if spring has just sprung. This road's curves at last broaden out, and the settlement appears in front of him. Along the edge of the camp, brightly colored people, mostly young, maybe 100 of them, take a last stand. Adam draws close. The work grows clearer. Community trench digging. Anarchic assembly of a drawbridge. Palisades and stockades rising from salvage timber. Spanning the moated entrance across the chopped-up road, a banner announces, "The Free Bioregion of Cascadia." The words sprout stems and tendrils. Birds perch on the letter's vegetation. Adam recognizes the style and knows the artist. He enters the Lincoln Log Fortress through the drawbridge over the trench in progress. Just past the defile, a man in camo and receding hairline ponytail lies in the middle of the road. His right arm stretches down his side like a reclining Buddha. His left disappears down a hole into the earth.
"Greetings, biped. You here to help or hinder?"
"Are you all right?"
"Name's Doug Fur. Just testing out a new lockdown. There's an oil drum full of concrete 6 feet down there. If they want me out, they're going to have to rip my arm off."
From a nest at the top of a tripod of lashed logs in the road, a small, dark-haired, ethnically ambiguous woman calls, "Everything okay?"
"That's Mulberry. She thinks you're a Freddy."
"What's a Freddy?"
"Just checking," Mulberry says.
"Freddies are the Federales."
"I don't think he's a Freddy. I'm just..."
"It's probably the button-down and chinos."
Adam looks up at the woman's tripod nest. She says, "They won't be able to take equipment down this road without knocking this over and killing me." The man with his arm in the ground clucks.
"Freddies won't do that. They think life is sacred. Human life, anyway. Crown of creation and such. Sentimental. It's the one chink in their armor."
"So if you're not a Freddy," Mulberry asks, "who are you?"
Something comes to Adam that he hasn't thought about for decades.
"I'm Maple."
Mulberry smiles a little crooked smile like she can see into him.
"Good. No maples here yet?"
Adam looks away, wondering whatever became of that tree. His backyard second self.
"Do either of you know a man called Watchman or a woman named Maidenhair?"
"Shit, yeah,"
the man chained to the earth says. The tripod woman grins.
"We don't have leaders here, but we do have those two."
His old fellow criminals greet Adam like they knew he was coming. Watchman clasps him by the shoulders. Maidenhair hugs him, long.
"It's good you're here. We can use you."
They've changed in some subtle way no personality test could quantify. Grimmer, more resolute. The death of Mimas has compressed them, like shale into slate. Their transformation makes Adam wish that he'd chosen some other topic to research. Resilience, immanence, noumen, qualities his discipline is notoriously poor in measuring. She grabs his wrist.
"We like to have a little ceremony when new people join."
Watchman sizes up Adam's pack. "You are joining us, right?"
"Ceremony?"
"Simple. You'll like it."
She's half right. The ceremony is simple. It happens that evening on a broad meadow behind the wall. The Free Bioregion of Cascadia assembles in parade dress, scores of people in plaid and grunge, floral, flowing hippie skirts topped off with fleece vests. Not all the congregation is young. A couple of stout abuelas stand by in sweatpants and cardigans. A former Methodist minister performs the ceremony. He's in his 80s, with a necklace scar where he lashed himself to a logging truck. They start in on the songs. Adam fights down his hatred of virtuous singing. The shaggy nature souls and their platitudes make him queasy. He feels ashamed, the way he does when remembering childhood. People take turns airing the day's challenges and suggesting cures. All around him spread the garish colors of ad hoc democracy. Maybe it's okay. Maybe mass extinction justifies a little fuzziness. Maybe earnestness can help his hurt species as much as anything. Who is he to say? The erstwhile minister says, "We welcome you, Maple. We hope you'll stay as long as you're able. Please, if it's in your heart to do so, repeat these words after me. From this day forward..."
From this day forward, he can't very well not repeat, with so many people assembled to watch him.
"I'll commit myself to respect and defend..."
"I'll commit myself to respect and defend..."
"The common cause of living things."
They aren't the most destructive words he has ever spoken, or the most pitiful. Something echoes in his head, something he once copied down. A thing is right. A thing is right when it tends... But he can't get to it. Cheers break out around his final echo. People set to work making a campfire. The blaze is high, wide, and orange, and the carbonizing wood smells like childhood.
"You're a psychologist," Mimi says to the recruit. "How do we convince people that we are right?"
The newest Cascadian takes the bait.
"The best arguments in the world won't change a person's mind. The only thing that can do that is a good story."
Maidenhair tells that story that the rest of the campfire knows by heart. First, she was dead, and there was nothing. Then she came back, and there was everything, with beings of light telling her how the most wondrous products of 4 billion years of life needed her help. An old Klamath guy with long gray hair and glasses like Clark Kent nods. He takes the floor for the benediction. He chants the old chants and teaches everyone a few words of Klamath Modoc.
"Everything happening here was already known. Our people said long ago that this day would come. They told of how the forest was about to die when humans suddenly remembered the rest of their family."
And for half the night, the characters sit around the blaze, laughing and listening and whispering and baying at the moon up in the spruce's spires. The next day is pure work. Trenches to be widened and deepened, a wall to be secured. Adam swings a hammer for hours. By evening, he's so tired he can't stand. He shares a cookout with the 4 friends who strike him as a Jungian archetypal family. Maidenhair, the mother priest. Watchman, the father protector. Mulberry, the child craftsman. And Doug Fir, child clown. Maidenhair is the glue, casting spells over everyone in camp. Adam marvels at her bulwark optimism, even after the routs she has suffered. She speaks with the authority of one who has already seen the future from high above. They take him in that night, a square 5th wheel. He's not sure what his role in this desperation-forged clan is supposed to be. Doug Fir calls him Professor Maple, and that's who he becomes. That night, he sleeps the deep oblivion of an exhausted volunteer. Adam raises his fears 2 nights later over a tin of baked beans warmed on a fire of cones. Destroying federal property. Serious stuff.
"Oh, you're a felon, buddy," Doug Fir says.
"Violent crime."
Douglas waves him away.
I've committed real violent crimes, commissioned by the government.
Mulberry clasps Douglas's jabbing hand. Yesterday's political criminals are on today's postage stamps. Maidenhair is far away in another country. At last she says, This isn't radical. I've seen radical. Then Adam sees it again, too. A living, breathing mountainside, stripped bare. Supplies arrive, bought with sympathizers' donations. The camp is a small part of a network of efforts spreading across the state. There's talk of an army walking arm in arm through the streets of the capital. A hunger striker camped out for 40 days and nights on the steps of the U.S. District Court in Eugene. The spirit of the forest, dressed in a quilt of green strips, walking 100 miles on stilts down Highway 58. That night, lying in his bag against the earth, Adam wants to head back to Santa Cruz to finish his thesis. Anyone can dig a trench, pile up an earthwork, fasten himself to a lockdown. But only he can complete his project and describe in measured facts why people might care whether a forest lives or dies. But he stays on another day, becoming something new, his own object of study. The longer the occupation lasts, the farther journalists travel to come see. A squad of men in a Forest Service van ask them all to leave. The Free Cascadians stand them off and send them away. Two guys in suits from the Congressional Representative's office drop by to listen. They promise to take the grievances to Washington. Their visit thrills Mulberry.
When politicians start to come around, something's happening.
Adam, Maple, agrees. Politicians want to be on the winning side. Blow the way the wind does. Maidenhair murmurs, The earth is always going to win. Headlights swing by the main road one night, and shots are fired. 3 days later, a deer's entrails appear just outside the barricade. A hulking F-350 Super Duty stops down the road, 100 yards from the drawbridge. Two men in high-necked olive hunter's jackets. The driver, young with a trim goatee, could be a C&W heartthrob.
What do we got here? Huggers! Hey! All right!
A girl called Trillium shouts,
We're just trying to protect a good thing!
Why don't you protect what belongs to you and let us protect our jobs and our family and our own mountains and our way of life? The trees don't belong to anyone, Doug Fir says. The trees belong to the forest.
The passenger door opens and the older man gets out. He walks around the front of the cab. Once, in another life, long ago, Adam took a seminar in the psychology of crisis and confrontation. Now he remembers nothing. The man is tall, but stooped, gray hair falling in his face. He's like a big grizzly pitching forward on his hind legs. Something flashes at the man's wrist. Adam thinks, Gun, knife, run! The old guy reaches the front left bumper and lifts the metal weapon. But the threat is soft, philosophical, perplexed, and the weapon only a metal hand.
I lost my arm at the elbow, cutting those trees.
The heartthrob calls from the cab,
And I've got white finger from working. You heard of working, haven't you? Doing things other people need to have done.
The old guy rests his good hand on the hood and shakes his head.
What do you people want? We can't stop using wood.
Maidenhair appears, walking through the drawbridge toward the men. The upright grizzly takes a step back.
She says, "We don't know what people can and can't do. So little has been tried."
The look of her sets the goateed driver on every kind of high alert.
"You can't put wood above the lives of decent people."
He's stunned. He wants her. That much is clear to Adam 100 yards away.
"We don't," she says. "We don't put trees above people. People and trees are in this together."
"What the hell does that even mean?"
"If people knew what went into making trees, they would be so, so thankful for the sacrifice. And thankful people don't need as much."
She talks to the men for a while. She says,
"We need to stop being visitors here. We need to live where we live, to become indigenous again."
The bear man shakes her hand. He walks back around to the passenger door and boards. As the monster truck pulls out, the driver yells to the assembled forces behind the drawbridge,
"Hug away, huggers! Y'all are gonna get reamed!"
He tears away in a spray of gravel. Yes, Adam thinks. Probably. And then the planet will ream the reamers. The protest enters its second month. It shouldn't be working, as far as Adam can see. The hopeless incompetence of the idealist temperament should have crashed the place long ago. But the free bioregion rolls on. Word spreads through camp that the president of the United States has heard about the protest and is ready to halt all federal timber salvage sales, especially those resulting from arson, until the policy can be reviewed. A bright, chilly afternoon, 2 hours past the sun's peak. Watchman is painting faces for storytelling that evening around the fire. Down the slope, someone blows an alpenhorn, bellowing like ancient megafauna at the falling sun. A marathoner named Martin sprints up to the ridge and trots into high camp.
"They're coming!"
"Who?" Watchman asks.
"Freddy's!"
Like that, the day is here. They head down the path toward the glacis, where the moat and wall now stand completed. Down the pass, along the logging road that Adam hiked up so long ago, a convoy crawls, filled with people wearing uniforms of 4 different colors and cuts. After the lead Forest Service van comes a behemoth excavator, converted for assault. Behind it, more equipment, more vans. The face-painted Free Cascadians stand and stare. Then the 80-year-old minister with the necklace scar says,
"Okay, folks, let's mobilize."
They move to their stations, locking down, raising the drawbridge, manning the wall, or withdrawing to defensible positions. Soon the convoy is at the gates. 2 Forest Service men exit the lead van and stand in front of the palisade.
"You have 10 minutes to leave peacefully. After that, you'll be removed to a place of detainment."
Everyone on the ramparts shouts at once. No leaders, every voice must be heard. The movement has lived for months by that principle, and now they'll die by it. Adam waits for a break in the hail of words. Then he, too, is shouting.
"Give us 3 days, and this whole thing can be wrapped up peacefully."
The heads of the convoy turn to him.
"We've had a visit from the congressional office. The president is assembling an executive order."
As quickly as he won their attention, he loses it.
"You have 10 minutes, the officer repeats, and Adam's political naivete dies.
Action from Washington isn't the answer to this showdown. It's the cause. At 9 minutes and 40 seconds, the long-necked Saurian excavator swings its ram over the trench and slams the top of the wall. Screams come from the battered ramparts. War-painted defenders tumble and run. Adam scrambles and is knocked to the ground. The claw hammers the wall again. It flicks out like a wrist and smacks the drawbridge. Another poke and the drawbridge shears off. Two hard swipes at the brace posts bring the entire barrier to the ground. Months of work. The most formidable barricades the free bioregion could build crumble like a child's popsicle stick fort. The beast rolls up to the trench and paws the rubble on the far side. It takes the excavator only a minute to scrape the logs from the destroyed wall and slide them into the moat. The treads of the machine roll over the filled trench and through the downed wall. Cascadians, their face paint running, pour like termites from a cracked open mound. Some head for the road. Several turn on the invaders with arguments and pleas. Maidenhair starts chanting, "Think of what you're doing! There's a better way!" Police from the convoy are everywhere, cuffing and forcing people to the ground. The chant changes to shouts of, "Nonviolence! Nonviolence!" Adam falls fast, taken down by an immense cop with rosacea so bad he looks like one of the painted eco-warriors. 50 yards up the escarpment, Watchman gets his knees clubbed from behind and slides down the scree on his blue-painted face. Only the lockdowns remain. The excavator slows its surge up the road. It reaches the first tripod and nudges at the base with its claw. The tripod wobbles. Officers turn from their mopping up to watch. Up in her crow's nest, Mulberry wraps her arms around the tops of the shaking pylons. Each slap of the claw against the cone's base flings her around like a crash dummy. Adam yells, "Jesus, quit!" Others pick up the yell. People on both sides of the battle. Even Doug, from his bed in the road.
"Meme, it's over! Come down!"
The claw slaps at the teepee's base. The three trunks forming the frame groan and bend. An awful creak, and one of the poles cracks. The crack starts 100 rings deep in the cylinder of lignin and opens outward. The fur rips, tearing off the top of the pole into a punji stake. Mimi screams, and her crow's nest falls. The torn pole impales her cheekbone. She bounces off the spike and topples, riding the wood down and bouncing off a rock at the bottom. Douglas releases himself from lockdown and runs toward her. The driver of the excavator yanks the claw away in horror, like a palm protesting its innocence. But the backhand swings into the child clown, who takes the force of the retracting claw and crumples like a string-snipped marionette. The war for Earth stops. Both sides rush to the wounded. Mimi shrieks and clutches her face. Douglas lies unconscious. Police run down to the caravan and call in the injuries. The dazed citizens of the collapsed free bioregion huddle in horror. Mimi rolls on her side in a fetal curl and opens her eyes. Trees in shades from jade to aquamarine skewer the sky. "Look the color," she thinks, then passes out. Adam finds Maidenhair and Watchman in the milling crowd, surveying the losses. Maidenhair points up the rise at the 4 insurgent women still lying across the road, locked down into the ground.
"We haven't lost yet,"
Adam says. "We have."
"They won't dare take these trees now. After the press gets wind of this?"
"They will. These and all the remaining ancients, until all forests are housing tracts or farms." Maidenhair shakes her dirty tresses.
"Those women can stay locked down until Washington acts."
Adam catches Watchman's eye. The truth is too brutal for even him to say. A helicopter airlifts the wounded to the Level 2 Trauma Center in Bend. Douglas undergoes immediate surgery for a LaFour-3 maxillary fracture. Mimi gets her ankle shoved back into place and her blown-out orbit patched. The ER doctor can do little for the trench across her cheek but sew it together until such a day as plastic surgeons might rebuild it. The Freddies press no charges against the squatters. Only the last four women, who hold out for another 36 hours, are jailed. Then the remaining residents of the free bioregion of Cascadia leave the hillside, and the extraction of wealth resumes. And yet, and still, 28 days later, a machine shed filled with vehicles in the Willamette National Forest goes up in flames. It isn't real. It's no more than theater, a simulation, until they see the aftermath. The newspapers run a photo, a fireman and two rangers inspecting a charred excavator. Five people pass the photo around Mimi Ma's dining room table. A thought joins them underground, as thoughts do so often now. Holy fuck. That's us. For a long time, there's no need for words. The shared mood swings like a volatile stalk. But it settles into a passive defiance.
They've gotten as good as they give, Mimi says.
The 22 stitches in her face make each word sting.
We're even.
Adam can't bear to look at her, or at Douglas either, his face another bandaged mess. Adam, too, wanted this revenge against equipment that half-blinded one of them and deformed another. Payback against the sadism of men. Now he doesn't know what he wants or how to get it. Actually, Nick says, they're still way ahead. It's a single act of desperation, but the need for justice is like ownership or love. Feeding it only makes it grow. 2 weeks after the machine shed, they target a sawmill near Solis, California, operating for months under a revoked license and paying the nuisance fine with a week's worth of profits. The woman who hears voices says how the attack must go. The trained observer does the stakeout. The engineer turns 24 plastic milk jugs into explosive devices. The vet handles the detonation. The psychologist keeps them going. Deadly machinery burns better than any of them expected. This time they leave a message scrawled on the side of a nearby warehouse, spared because it's filled with blameless timber. The letters are artful, almost florid. No to the suicide economy. Yes to real growth. They sit hunched around Mulberry's table as if they're about to deal a hand of cards. Philosophy and other fine distinctions can't help them now. A line has been crossed. The job is done. Words are of no consequence. And still, they can't stop talking, although the sentences are never long. Still debating, when their argument's conclusion has long since disappeared in the rearview mirror of their delivery van. Adam watches his fellow arsonists, taking mental notes despite himself. Mulberry chops the air in slow motion. She lands the blade edge on a precise point in her open palm.
I feel like I've been at a continuous funeral for 2 years.
Ever since the blinders came off, the child clown agrees.
All the protests, all the letters, getting beat up, shouting at the top of our lungs, and no one hearing.
We accomplished more in 2 nights than we did with years of effort.
Accomplishment is not something Adam knows how to measure anymore. What they're doing, what he has done, is simply to make the pain stop long enough to bear. Mimi says,
it's not a funeral anymore.
Not a hard choice,
Nick says. His voice falls quiet, astonished by the ambush of common sense. We destroy a small amount of equipment, or that equipment destroys a huge amount of life. The psychologist listens. There are other, much deeper deceptions at the heart of humans. He has thrown in his lot with the need to save what can be saved. A little time must be bought from the approaching apocalypse. Nothing else matters more than that. His thesis has its answer. Olivia needs only lower her chin and the others fall silent. Her spell over them has grown with each crime. She has put her hand on a cut stump as big as a chapel. She has watched a forest die that was older than her species. She has taken advice from things larger than man. If we are wrong, we pay the price. They can't take more than our lives. But if we're right, she casts her eyes downward in a shaft of thought, and everything alive tells me that we are. No one needs her to complete the thought. What wouldn't a person do to help the most wondrous products of 4 billion years of creation? In the time it takes for Adam to think this thought, he realizes something else. The five of them are going on another run. One more. It must be the last. Then they'll go their separate ways, having done what little they could to stop the race from killing itself. Adam himself discovers the story. Forest Service seeks multi-use projects. Thousands of acres of public lands in Washington, Idaho, Utah, and Colorado offered for lease to private speculators and developers. Forests cleared for more end-time profit. The group hears the report in silence. There's no need even to put the matter to a vote. There are no letters or emails, and almost no calls. They communicate face-to-face, or not at all. They live on cash. Nothing is written down. Mulberry's engineering grows more sophisticated. She starts in on her best work by far, tipped by handmade underground tracts. The 4 rules of arson. Setting fires with electrical timers. The new design is more reliable. Maple and Doug Fir drive as far as 50 miles away to get her the needed supplies. Watchman and Maidenhair surveil one of the newly leased sites, Storm Castle, in Idaho, in the Bitterroots, near the Montana border. Healthy chunks of public forest sold off to make way for yet another four-season resort. They make the journey and tour the site at night, when the place is abandoned. The artist sketches everything. The newly cut roadbeds, the equipment sheds and construction trailers, the footprint of the resort's fresh foundations. There is zeal in his perfect sketches, and humility. While he draws, the actuarial science dropout wanders the cleared ground, pacing out distances between survey stakes. She tilts her head, listening. All five of them work in Mulberry's garage, under a fume tent, in full-body painter suits and gloves. They assemble cascades of 5-gallon fuel buckets and timer devices in plastic Tupperware. They mark on watchmen's maps where each of the devices must go to create the most sustainable burn. They'll send this one last message and be done. Then they'll split up. Fade back into invisible routine, having gotten the country's attention, appealed to the consciences of millions, planted a seed, the kind that needs fire to open. Everything goes into the back of the van. By the time Mulberry's garage door rises and they edge out, it's like they're headed toward the mountains for camping and a hike. They pack a police scanner, gloves and balaclava masks for all. They're all dressed in black. They leave Western Oregon in early morning, any accident as they cruise down the interstate, and the van will ignite in a massive fireball. In the van, they chatter and watch the scenery. They pass through long stretches of Potemkin forest, vista curtains only a few feet deep. Doug produces a book of trivia questions and quizzes the others on the Revolutionary and Civil Wars. Adam wins. They birdwatch, raptors along the highway's corridor of small mammal carnage. 2 hours in, Mimi spots a bald eagle with a 7-foot wingspan. It hushes everyone. They listen to a book on tape, Myths and Legends of the First People of the Northwest. The old man of the ancients, Chemosh, springs up from the ashes of the northern lights and makes everything. Coyote and Wishpush tear up the landscape in their epic fight. The animals get together to steal fire from Pine Tree. And all the darkness's spirits shift shapes, as numerous and fluid as leaves. Night falls in the Bitterroots. The last few miles are the hardest, slow, winding, and remote. At last they pull up to the staging area, 2 miles off the state highway. The site looks just the way Watchman drew it. Mimi stays in the van, a scarf around her scarred face, sweeping the radio frequencies with a police scanner. The others set wordlessly to work. All tasks have been talked through dozens of times. They move like a single creature, wrestling 5-gallon fuel containers into place and daisy-chaining them with wicks of towel and sheet doused in propellant. Then they affix the Tupperware timers. Watchman sets off on the job assigned to him. Tonight is his last chance to work in a medium that will be seen by millions. He heads away from the future resort's half-framed main lodge, where the others deploy their devices. Across the graded meadow he comes to a pair of trailers, too far from the action for the blasts to reach. Their walls are his best available canvas. He takes 2 cans of spray paint from his coat pockets and steps up to the cleaner of the trailer's wall. In letters filled with all the care his hand can compose, he writes, "Control kills. Connection heals." He steps back to appraise the germ of the only thing he knows for certain. With a large felt marker, he adorns the block caps in stems and twigs, until the letters seem to be sprouting back from apocalypse. They look like Egyptian hieroglyphs, or the dancing figures of an op-art bestiary. Below these 2 lines, he adds the trailing hope, "Come home or die." Back at the detonation site, wrestling the tubs into place, Adam and Doug mistime their movements. Fuel slops onto the hem of Adam's jacket and down his black denims. Stinking of petrochemicals, he squeezes his fists until his soaked gloves drip. His grip is shot from so much lifting. He looks up at the peaked roof of the construction office and thinks, "What the hell am I doing?" The clarity of recent weeks, the sudden waking from sleepwalk, his certainty that the world has been stolen and the atmosphere trashed for the shortest of short-term gains, the sense that he must do all he can to fight for the living world's most wondrous creatures, all these abandon Adam, and he's left in the insanity of denying the bedrock of human existence. Property and mastery. Nothing else counts. Earth will be monetized until all trees grow in straight lines, 3 people own all 7 continents, and every large organism is bred to be slaughtered. On the side of the other trailer, Watchman paints words in an alphabet wild and vivid. Verse springs up and flows over the empty white. "For you have 5 trees in paradise, which do not change, either in summer or in winter, and their leaves do not fall. He who knows them shall not taste of death." He steps back, his throat tightening, a little surprised by what has come out of him, this prayer he needs so badly to send out to no one who will understand it. Then,
whump!
And he's hit in the back by a concussion wave. Heat blows outward on the air, long before there should be anything like an explosion. Watchman turns to see a ball of orange leap up in a quick, simulated sunrise. His legs pitch forward, and he's running toward the blaze. Another figure cuts in on the edge of his sight. Douglas, his hobbled run, one leg stiff, a dotted rhythm. They reach the burning at the same time. Then, Douglas, shout whispering,
"Fuck no! Fuck no!"
He's on his knees, mewling at what has happened. Two figures lie on the ground. One of them starts to move as Nick closes in, and not the one Nick needs to be moving. Adam pulls his shoulders off the ground. His head periscopes in all directions. A veil of blood trickles down his face. "Oh," he says. "Oh." Douglas steadies him. Nick swoops down to lift Olivia. She's lying on her back, her face to the stars. Her eyes are open. All around them the air turns orange.
"Livy?"
His voice is horrible, the thick, slurring burr of it, worse for her than the blast.
"Can you hear me?"
A bubble forms on her lips. Then the word, Something seeps from her side, down by her waist. The front of her black shirt glistens in the dark. He lifts it and cries out, rushing it back down. A hushed wail comes out of him. Then he's a monster of competence again. The injured woman looks at him in terror. He shuts himself up and blanks his face, goes through all the motions of every possible aid. The air starts to flicker. Two figures cowl over them. Douglas and Adam.
"Is she..."
Something in the words hits Olivia. She tries to raise her head. Nick gentles her down.
"I'm..."
she says. Her eyes close again. Everything scalds. Douglas spins around in tight circles, his hands pressed against his skull. Clipped sounds come out of him.
"Shit, shit, shit, shit!"
"We have to move her," Adam says. Nick blocks his advance.
"We can't."
"We have to. The flames." Their clumsy scuffle is over before it starts. Adam takes the woman under her arms and drags her across the stony ground. Sounds percolate up her throat. Nick bends down beside her again, helpless. He'll see the image for the next 20 years. He rises, stumbles away, and vomits on the ground. Then Mimi is there, next to them in the dark. Relief runs through Nick. Another woman. A woman will know how to save them. At a glance, the engineer sees everything. She pushes the van keys into Adam's hands.
"Go! Back to that last town we came through. 10 miles. Get the police."
"No,"
the woman on the ground says, startling everyone.
"Don't. Keep."
Adam points at the blaze.
"I don't care," Mimi says. "Go! She needs help!"
Adam stands still, his body objecting. Help won't help her, and it will kill us all.
"Finish,"
the prone woman murmurs. The word is so soft, not even Nick can make it out. Adam stares at the keys in his hand. He leans forward until he's trotting toward the van.
"Douglas!"
Mimi snaps.
"Stop!"
The vet quits moaning and holds still. Then Mimi is on the ground, ministering to Olivia, opening her collar, calming the animal panic. "Help is coming. Stay still." Words only agitate the gored woman.
"No. Finish. Keep."
Mimi hushes her, stroking the side of her face. Nick slinks back. He watches from a distance. Everything is happening, unfixable, forever, for real. But on another planet, to other people. Things seep out of Olivia's middle. The lips move. Mimi leans in her ear to Olivia's mouth.
A little water?
Mimi spins and looks up at Nick. Water! He freezes, helpless.
I'll find some,
Douglas shouts. He sees a dimple in the hillside beyond the blaze.
That's a ravine! There must be a stream down there.
The men search for something to hold the water. Every container they have is tainted with accelerants. There's a baggie in Nick's pocket. He empties it of its few sunflower seeds and gives it to Douglas, who heads off into the woods behind the construction site. It's not hard to find the stream, but a learned aversion grips Douglas as he dips the baggie.
You can't drink water from outside.
There isn't a lake, pond, stream, or rivulet in the country that's safe to drink. He clenches down and fills the bag. The woman just needs to hold a thimble of cool, clear liquid in her mouth, however poisonous. Douglas cups the bag and runs it back up the hillside. He pours a little water into her mouth.
Thank you.
Her eyes are feverish with gratitude.
That's good.
She drinks a little more. Then her eyes close. Douglas holds the baggie, helpless. Mimi dips her fingers into the fluid and wipes off Olivia's streaked face. She cradles the head, strokes the chestnut hair. The green eyes open again. They're alert now, cognizant, fixing on the eyes of their nurse. Olivia's face twists up in terror like an ambushed mare. As clearly as if she speaks the words out loud, she puts the idea into Mimi's skull.
Something's wrong. I've been shown what happens, and this isn't it.
Mimi holds her gaze, absorbing what pain she can. Comfort is impossible. The two lock eyes, and neither can look away. The gutted woman's thoughts pour into Mimi through a widening channel, thoughts too large and slow to understand. Nick stands still, eyes closed. Douglas throws the baggie on the ground and stumbles away. The sky flares up, bright with refusal. Two new explosions rip through the air. Olivia cries out, searching for Mimi's gaze again. Her stare turns violent, clutching, as if looking away, even for an instant, would be worse than the worst death. A third man appears on the inferno's edge. The sight of Adam, so much sooner than he should be back, restarts Nick.
Did you get help?
Adam looks down at the Pietà. Some part of him seems surprised to find that the drama is still going on.
Is help coming?
Nick shouts. Adam says nothing. With all his will, he pushes back from madness.
You gutless! Give me the keys! Give me the keys!
The artist charges the psychologist, grappling. Only the sound of his name in Olivia's mouth stops Nick from violence. He's on the ground next to her in a heartbeat. She's breathing hard now, her face fists up in pain. Whatever shock has kept her anesthetized is wearing off, leaving her contorted and panting.
Nick!
The panting stops. Her eyes go huge. He must fight to keep from looking over his shoulder for the terror that she sees. I'm here. I'm here.
Nick?
A shriek now. She tries to sit, and soft things spill out under her shirt.
Nick?
Yes, I'm here. Right here. I'm with you.
The panting starts up again. Objection trickles from her mouth. Her grip crushes his fingers. She moans, and the noise leaks away until there's no louder sound than the flames on three sides of them. Her eyes squeeze shut. Then they open, wild. She stares, unsure what she's looking at.
How long can it last?
Not long, he promises. She claws at him, an animal falling from a great height. Then she calms again.
not this. This will never end. What we have. Right?
He waits.